It's the Kate Turkington show. I'm Kate Turkington. Stay with me. I've got a great story to tell you, a great guest for you to listen to and watch. In Port of Calabar in Eastern, as it was then, Eastern Nigeria. And this house was supposed to be haunted by the ghost of Sir Roger Casement. Who is Sir Roger Casement, you may ask? Okay, bit of history. Roger Casement worked for the British Civil Service, went over to the Congo, King Leopold's fiefdom in those days, and he actually revealed some of the worst excesses of Leopold, the mutilations, the deaths, the dreadful things he was doing in the, as it was then, the Belgian Congo to the locals. Roger Casement was so descriptive to his report. And some of you may have read Conrad's Heart of Darkness, The Terror, The Terror. Joseph Conrad took quite a lot of Roger Casement's reports and used them as background for that novel, The Heart of Darkness. So there's more to it, but so dodgy was the British government with Roger Casement. They knighted him. He became Sir Roger Casement. But now, bad things start happening because the Great War, World War I, 1914 to 18, started, and Ireland had always its independence. And on Easter Sunday in 1916, there was a rebellion in Dublin. If you go to Dublin, you can still see the bullet hole marks in the post office. Roger Casement, obviously being Irish, sided with the Irish rebels. And he had been in Germany trying to drum up support for the Irish rebels. And he came to the coast of Ireland, put foot, immediately arrested by the British authorities. And he was taken to London. He was the very last man, a knight of the realm. The very last man to be hanged at Pentonville Prison. I was a very young bride in this wooden house in Calabar in Nigeria, and we were told by the previous occupant it was haunted by the ghost of Roger Casement. Nobody knew why he was haunting a particular house. I was very young, even more cynical probably than I am now, and it was a so-haunted wing. Which was actually a euphemism for two very dusty rooms. Anyway, got the rooms cleaned up, put my two children in there. Simon was four, Sarah was two. And in they went. And a few weeks went by. One night, about 6 weeks later, I went into the bedroom, and Simon, aged four, said to me, Mummy, why does that man with long black beard never say good night to us? When I went back to the UK, because there was no social media, very little communication in those days, I went to the British Museum, one of my first stops, and there were photographs of Roger Casement, this thin, pale, ascetic face, and the long black beard. Mummy, why does a man long black beard never say good night. My guest has dabbled, more than dabbled, with the supernatural. I want to introduce you to one of my favorite authors of all time, John Connolly. Many of you will be familiar, particularly with his Charlie Parker novels. He writes superb crime novels, but it's not the wham bam, thank you, ma'am. They're literary, they're beautiful, they're well plotted, the characters are unforgettable. And he's joining me this morning to talk to us. John, such a pleasure to have you there. And that's a true story about Roger Kisman.
That's lovely. I've learned something about Roger Casement from you, so thank you very much. It's nice to see you again, Kate, after so many years. You're looking well.
You're a mere slip of a boy, and I was in the full flower of adult womanhood. Now things have changed still looking great. Now, John, your latest book, Children of Eve, brings back Charlie Parker. Charlie, you tell us who Charlie Parker is. You describe him to us.
Charlie Parker is a private investigator. He is a widower. He has also lost a child, and he has struggled with grief and loss for a long time. And gradually he has become aware that his something of his child remains, that something of his child persists. And it has opened a kind of torrent of empathy in him. He has gone from somebody who was angry and grief-stricken to being somebody who is immensely empathic and compassionate and is very reluctant to stand by and watch the powerless or the vulnerable being trampled underfoot by the powerful or the wealthy. And he's also aware that he may have another identity, that there may be something in his past that is drawing all of this evil to him, that he is a magnet for a reason. And so the books are now, I think there have been 24 stories concerning him and 22 novels. And that series is, I think, gradually drawing to a conclusion because his history deserves an ending, I think.
Please, not yet. Let's have one or two more. John, you raised a point there. We arrived to the log cabin deep in the Midlands last night, some of my family, a couple of birthdays. And we got, after a couple of glasses of wine, and because I was talking to you today, we got onto the whole topic of evil. And we had a very, very heated discussion because I said, I have been alive so long, and I'm either stupid or evil, maybe both. I don't think I have ever met a truly evil person, and I don't know if evil exists. And the sky fell on my head like Henny Penny, let me tell you. Now, evil, can you define your kind of evil that you write about?
Well, I think there are two levels of evil in the novels. You know, most people don't get up in the morning and decide they want to commit acts of evil, but they're quite capable of doing so. But they'll do it because they're frightened or they're angry or they're envious or they're greedy. And these are very human motivations. But out of them can come the most appalling acts. And I think we're all, you only have to open the newspaper to see that. I suppose what the Parker novels ask is, are there extremities of human behavior that seem to draw on a deeper well, a deeper, older, more atavistic well? And I still wear the little pilgrim cross that I gave Parker in the novels. It's a Byzantine pilgrim's cross, and I'm very fond of it. Because I come from a Catholic background. My background is Irish Catholic. I'm a bit of a Christmas Day Catholic, I suppose. I'm one of the Catholics. Pope Benedict, the old Pope, would probably have liked to burn in St. Peter's Square for not putting in the effort. But I suppose if you're raised in a Judeo-Christian tradition, you have a conception of goodness that is beyond human, and therefore you also have a conception of its opposite. And so that has fed into the books. You know, why do we behave well simply because it makes us better neighbors? Do we behave well because we aspire to a condition that is beyond human? Do we hope to be rewarded in the next world? And I think the mystery novel, for me, just provided a forum to explore those ideas. I don't have any answers to them, no more than you do. But I think they added a different layer to the novels and a different texture to the novels from the standard crime novel. They were willing to engage with these subjects, to discuss faith, to discuss goodness, and to discuss conceptions of evil.
Well, one of the things I love about your novels, I read with the spirit of summer lightning. I think it's a kind of gene. But with your novels, I'm often pulled short. And I'll go back, particularly when Charlie Parker waxes a bit philosophical, I'm pulled short and I actually go back and I will read that thought he's just had. I think this is where you're writing. I know, maybe James Lee Burke, another favorite author of mine, maybe he does it too, but it's something you do deliberately. And let me come to the question, sorry. How much of you is Charlie Parker? You must have been asked that 3 million times. Is there a dark side lurking there inside this lovely smiling face? Or do you introduce evil? Do you introduce the supernatural? Is it there? Is it part of you?
I think Parker is more troubled than I am. He is also probably more compassionate than I am. I think when we create central characters like this, we try to create better versions of ourselves. But I have given every sin I've committed to somebody in the books, you know, and I think it's very easy to say that, well, I am the good character. You brought up James Lee Burke. And I remember having a similar discussion with James Lee Burke when I interviewed him. And Burke said, I am the good people in my books. He said, they're a manifestation of me. And the evil in his books, he said, because Burke, as you say, also comes from a Judeo-Christian background, is also very interested in conceptions of evil. Burke said, the evil in my books, that's something outside of myself. And actually, I didn't believe him. And I'm not sure he believed himself, because Burke was a man who had been through Alcoholics Anonymous. He had put his family through a terrible time. I think he'd come out at the other end of it. But I don't think you can live that kind of life and be able to make that kind of separation. And it seemed to me that he was not being truthful. And he's somebody I deeply admire. So there is a lot of Parker in me, but he's not me. You know, I've often described him as a prism. He is a way of refracting my experiences and my view of the world. And I use him as a way of, you know, when you shine a beam of light through a prism, you get a spectrum. And so you get a different perspective on the light. And I think that's what Parker is for me and all of the characters in the book. And one of the challenges I've set myself probably is that even the worst of the characters in the books, I want the reader to feel some kind of connection with them. I want them to feel that they're not entirely separate from ourselves. And I remember, I think it was Anthony Hopkins being asked about Hannibal Lecter. And I think he was asked, how can you portray somebody who is so depraved, I suppose? And it's a question actors get asked quite often. And Hopkins' answer was very interesting. He said that you find the little part of yourself, the little angry, hateful part of yourself that could be that person, and you expand it into a performance. And there's something of that when I write those more troubled characters, or those characters, if we want to label them as evil, they wouldn't label themselves that way. I try to put that little part of myself in them. It is a way of exploring those elements of my behavior and human behavior. You know, it's that, what was it? It was Marcus Aurelius. I am human, and therefore nothing human is alien to me. And that goes for the good as well as the evil, I suppose.
And now, this latest book, The Children of Evil, and I love it because it's a nice long book. It's something you can really get your teeth into. It's set in South America. It's set over on the west coast of America. And Spanish. Do you speak Spanish, John, by the way?
I do. I began learning it a few years back because my Spanish readership had increased, and I was very embarrassed about going to Spain and Latin America and not being able to do interviews. So now it's a little bit rusty. I have to go back to Spain and Latin America next year, and I will take quite intensive classes to get it back up to speed. But I like to be able to do radio interviews and public interviews in Spanish. So yes, I have Spanish.
Okay. And the book, I mean, Peru is in it as well. I don't want to give too much away because it is a mystery. And it's about John, you do the description.
Sure. It's hard to talk about it without giving too much away. But I did. Don't. The first thing is that I don't write about places I haven't been. So I had been in Mexico a few years back. So I'd been to Teotihuacan, which is the old city outside that has survived. You know, unlike a lot of the ancient civilizations, it hadn't been knocked down and destroyed because various people had come in and colonized it. But I had also been to Argentina, and I had managed. I wanted to go to a place called Cafayate, which is in the center of the country, and I had bought one of those guidebooks that advises you to go off the beaten track. But unfortunately, I went off the beaten track in a car that wasn't suited to the beaten track. And so I ended up marooned in the middle of the desert in the dead of night. And the police had to come and rescue me completely accidentally. They happened to be passing as my car threatened to go on fire. And it kind of poisoned me on Cafayate. By the time I got there, I wasn't really in the mood to stay there. And I ended up traveling a little bit. And I came across, writers are magpies. We tend to go looking for shiny things that we can steal. We may not think we might never use them, but they're shiny and interesting. And I came across just a very strange piece of art, strange, macabre, tender piece of archaeological history. And I filed it away. I remember thinking, at some point, this will be useful to me. And it was in the writing of the Children of Eve that came about. And so the background to the Children of Eve is entirely true. And one of the things I also try to do in the books is that I try to anchor as much as possible in the real world. And in fact, because I think then it makes it much harder for the readers to spot the join between what's real and what's unreal. And it makes the suspension of disbelief much easier. And when you're writing novels, as I do, that have a certain supernatural or numinous element to them, it's very important that the reader is sucked into it, that the reader at no point expresses skepticism about what they're seeing or what they're being told. And so it required an awful lot of research, even to, you know, a chunk of the book is set in Nashville and the area around the Tennessee border. And you could drive all of those roads and you can see all of the places that I mentioned, because I drove all of those roads with my notebook and my camera. So it becomes almost like scouting a film. You're looking for the perfect locations and you're looking for places that suit the plot, because I want the reader to be immersed. And for mystery fiction, place is incredibly important. For readers who read a lot of mystery fiction, we associate our favorite characters with the cities or the locales that they come from, and they become a character in the novels. And if you get the character right and the location right, you get a kind of resonance. You get something that's greater than the sum of its parts. So I've always put in the time to go and visit and research and talk to people who know a little bit more about things than I do. One of the great things about being a journalist, as you know, is that you're not afraid to ask a question and show that you don't know something. You know, you're quite prepared to have somebody explain something to you. And I've never been ashamed. As I said to me, there are no stupid questions. If you don't know something, you ask. And I've always been very open about that.
Of course you'd. And then how do you live between the other part of the novel, set in Portland, up on the West Coast there, and there again you're taking us into restaurants, you're taking us into all kinds of places that you're not only is Charlie Parker familiar with, but you're obviously familiar with too. Same thing.
Yeah, Portland, Maine is a character in the books too. And again, we have a house over there. I spend time over there. And I like the fact that a reader could walk the streets and see all of those places. You're creating a kind of shadow version of the city. That's what it is. It's not quite the city, but it's the city. It's a kind of city. It's a kind of haunted version of the city. For example, there is a bar at the center of the books called The Great Lost Bear. And people are always surprised that The Great Lost Bear actually exists. And its owners are characters in the books. And I remember when I wanted to include it originally, because I had gone drinking there and I had met them and they knew who I was. And I remember saying to Dave Evans, the former owner of the bear, I said, and he was the owner at the time, I said to him, look, would it be okay if Parker, you know, Parker was going through a difficult time, and he says, okay, if this becomes a kind of home away from home for him, he works there a little bit. It's a kind of a substitute office. And Dave said, sure. And I said to Dave, just to let you know, I won't kill anybody in the bar. And Dave said, you can kill anyone you want and you can start with the line chefs. And I remember, it was a lovely thought, you know. I mean, Dave just, he'd had it with the line chefs at that stage after about 20 years of them. I love that idea. Yeah, I love the idea that people can come in and see the place and experience the place. And if they can't get to it, they can experience it through the books.
Now, I'm a bit worried, John. You're saying you're thinking you're coming to the end of Charlie Parker's journey. You can't. Are you really thinking that? Or are you going to give too
much? I have always thought writer. What happens to writers is that we tend to just die. We drop off the perch. You know, I'll be in a bizarre piano accident as I head into Johannesburg today or whatever it might be. And people would say, God, he was so full of life in that Kate Turkington interview. It's so sad. And then they'll just go and read, you know, fake Lee Child books or whatever it is. And I have thought for a very long time that that these books were almost like individual chapters in a larger story. And that that story should have a conclusion. And it's not something writers do. Like I said, we tend to die, or very occasionally a writer will end a series. The most famous example is probably Colin Dexter deciding that he wanted to give Morse an ending. But that was really because Colin had just got tired of writing. He didn't enjoy it anymore. He wanted to sit and do crossword puzzles in his local pub and have a glass of wine. And God bless him, why not? You know, he'd reached that age. I want to see if it's possible to give readers a conclusion that does not disappoint them, that feels appropriate to the story. And also, we're in a slightly awkward position. It was one of the things I'm going to talk about at the events in Cape Town and in Johannesburg, in that we're very close for the first time, and I've been very careful about the books, to a television series. In fact, I'm signing the deal for that next week.
Oh, great.
Yes and no. I'm a little ambivalent about it. And I've told them I'm a little ambivalent about it. Because what they want to do is they want to do just 5 seasons. And they want to sew the ending at the beginning. They want the series to have a conclusion. Yeah. And if that's the case, I need to time my books so that my books would have to end at the same time their series ends. And like I said to you earlier, I'm so used to looking at the world through Parker's eyes and through the eyes of Angel and Louis. It would cause me a lot of pain, and it will be a very difficult decision if I have to do it. And one of the things Children of Eve does is try to give me a way of staying in that universe if not all of the characters are able to be involved, I suppose is the best way of putting it. But I am genuinely ambivalent about it, because you mentioned James Lee Burke earlier, and James Lee Burke is still writing into his 80s. I'm 57 at the moment. I know, a very youthful 57, but never mind.
The last one, I think, lost the plot a bit.
but he's still writing. And you know, the idea that my second half of my career could be longer than the first half of my career. And how do I do that if I don't have this character that I love? And I'm genuinely at a difficult point in my career. These are questions that are keeping me awake at night. And so I, as a fan and as somebody who loves long-form television, yes, I would love to see my character on the big screen. Colin Farrell wants to do it. I would love to see Colin Farrell as Charlie Parker. I think it would be perfect casting. But at the same time, I would watch it begin with a little sense of regret that it would mark the beginning of the end of something that's been incredibly important to me. And that's being very honest about it.
Do you know, John, I'm just trying to think who it was, but I can't remember, but many moons ago I was interviewing a famous author, sorry, I don't remember, and his chief book, not The Remains of the Day, it wasn't Ishiguro, but it was somebody very famous, and he said the only way he could cope with his novel being, as it was, into a movie, into a film, which had totally divorced himself from the process, because he said they're two totally different genres. Literature and film are two different genres, and that was the only way he could cope. Maybe you have to switch off. I don't know. Maybe you've got to
switch off. Well, I mean, you could obviously say yes, the television goes in one direction and you go in another, but it would be very awkward. I think it would be difficult, and I would be. I mean, I'm not collaborative by nature, so my involvement with the series would just be to answer questions when they had them. But I think it would be quite difficult if the series went in one direction and I went in another at the end. I think that would be quite hard for readers to take. So I think it would have to be almost two parallel tracks working towards the same destination, in that they will, I know that they're talking about taking a different route and cherry picking storylines from books and creating a kind of different narrative. And I find that fascinating from an objective point of view. That's a very clever creative decision and a very imaginative creative decision. And their decision also to give it an ending is the right one. But as the person who has created the character, to feel that some of the momentum has been taken out of your hands, that's a little bit more difficult to take. But we shall see. It may never happen in that, you know, as an example, the first book of mine to be optioned for film was Bad Men when it came out. And that was in 2003. And earlier this year, the script was sent back to the original scriptwriter for revisions. He has, you know, children who are nearly as old as grown-up children nearly as old as the script now. You know, with the best will in the world, sometimes these things never happen, you know. So I may be worrying about something that never comes to pass. But if it does, we will make the best of it.
I'm already trying to cast Charlie Pop. I'm trying to think of an actor who I remember talking to Mick Herron when his when Slow Horses was option. He wouldn't say. He said, "I'm so excited because they've got this actor, and I can't tell you who it was." Gavin, of course. I think it's like. I mean, it's your baby, it's your life, it's your spirit, it's your creation. And as you say, to hand it over willy-nilly, I don't know you all that well. I sense that it will be very hard for you to do that.
Well, it would. I don't, but also it's not, in this case, it's not kind of willy-nilly in that I've been very careful about it. I've been very protective of the books up until now. But the two people who want to do it are Colin Farrell's production company. So Colin initially wanted to do Parker, and I still think he does, and he's perfect. And Bryan Cranston's production company. So Bryan Cranston, who had obviously done Breaking Bad. And Colin, both because he's an Irish person working in an American idiom, and because actually we share a birthday, curiously, it seems almost, you know, if I looked at Colin, I would say yes. You know, Parker is not physically a big man. He's not imposing in a Jack Reacher sense. But also the fact that, like I said, Colin is this very, very talented actor who can immerse himself in American characters, yet he was born in the same city that I was. And so there seems an appropriate point of connection there. And like I said, there was a meeting initially of the people who wanted to do it with me, and they were all very, very smart, creative people. And I thought, if anybody's going to do it, these people should be the ones who do it. So I have absolute faith in them. Like I said, the only reservation is that it will set a clock ticking, and I will have to live with that.
Maybe that clock is ticking anyway.
It's ticking for all of us.
Tempest, fugite. Oh, God. Tempest, fugite. Can't remember the end of that. And because we talk about travel too, just finally, a couple of places. Do you have a favourite place, and B, a place you never go back to? Favourite place.
I can say the place I'd rather never go back to is Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport, which I think maybe every time I've gone to Phoenix Airport, I've had a bad experience. So if I could avoid ever going there again, I would be perfectly happy. You know, it's funny, and I'm not just saying that because we're speaking. My wife is South African. You've known her. You knew her before you knew me. my son now lives here with his wife in Cape Town, and my first grandchild has been born. So that's the reason why we're over to see, one of the reasons we're over is to see our new grandson. So I have a huge degree of affection for South Africa now. And Jenny and I have discussed, you know, maybe at some point, if this is where our grandchildren are going to be, because our younger son is not at that stage yet, that we would want to spend more time here. So over the years, because I've been coming here now since 2000, that was when I met Jenny first. So I developed a huge affection for Cape Town and South Africa, and I have friends here. I'm very fond of it. I have no illusions about the country. I don't come here just thinking it's everything is great, but I have had almost no bad experiences here. So I suppose South Africa and Portland, Maine, where Parker's home is, I'm always happy in Portland. So those two places. But there's a lovely bookstore down in Phoenix, and they're always asking me to go because they've been hugely supportive. And the main reason I don't go often is because I can't bear flying into that airport and flying out of it again, because I know I'm going to have a bad experience. So it's funny. Some places just become hexed for you, you know? They just become bad luck places, and you know you should avoid them.
Oh, John, it's been so great talking. Absolutely a delight talking to you.
Okay, it's so lovely. It's so lovely to see you again. I'm very fond of you, so thank you.
We've only talked about the Charlie Parker notes. I mean, you're a prolific writer, all your other good stuff. Just that Charlie Parker's just an angel and Louis and the characters. They're part of my life and they're part of so many of your readers' lives. John, have a good time while you're here in South Africa. Such a pleasure to talk to you. And look for some ghosts. Look for some ghosts.
I'll do my best, Kate. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.